This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 69. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network. I am your host, Riley Bowman. And today, we also have with us Jacob Paulson.
Hi, Riley.
Hi, Jacob. Beautiful day today, huh?
Yeah, not bad for November.
Yeah, it's. I think the high forecast for today in Denver is 71 degrees.
We'll take it.
Yeah, totally. Anyway, today is, what do we have here? November 14th. We just got past Veterans Day. I hope everyone had a great Veterans Day. Now we are moving forward to Thanksgiving. But here on this November 14th is our usual news episode of the podcast. Today we got all kinds of stories talking about open carry, maybe, you know, happening in a new state, a state that hasn't encouraged it quite, you know, as other states have. Stuff about Donald Trump, all kinds of fun stuff. A couple of great justified stories I'm really looking forward to getting to. So more on that a little bit later, but today's episode of the podcast, I should slow down, Jacob, is brought to you by the Armory Tool, which is something we just got in stock here. It's actually really cool. I'm holding one in my hands. So we'll talk about that a little bit more in a little bit. But before we get any further into our news stories in particular, let's cover a quick training tip. And today's tip is what I would call moving your gun to line of sight.
I like it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So the whole idea is we want to be able to get our sights on target or our gun on target quickly, right? And so this is just a quick exercise. It's real simple. It's easy to do. Anybody can do it. And it's good practice. And, you know, I typically will do this where I have my gun held in at the what I call the compressed ready. So the gun is close, tight to the body. It's like your position four, you know, if you think in terms of the draw stroke from a holster, where five is actually fully extended, pointing at the target. So I sometimes will do this with my gun back in position four, and then I push out straight to the target. But I'm focusing on the target with my eyes, right? And the whole idea is that I want to get, you know, I'm focused on the target with the eyes, and I push out to the target and wait for that, you know, the sights to come in line with that target. Another good way of doing this, and I'll do it this way too, but I practice probably the other way more because that's probably more like I would actually hold and handle my gun, mostly because I'm coming from like a holster or something. But that is to just hold the gun down to low ready. And to once again focus on something with your eyes, and then bring up the gun until you can basically visualize the sights on line with the target. This could also be done too with a high ready. So you're holding the gun more at an upward, you know, 45 degree angle, kind of more or less in front of your face. And then once again, focus on a target and push straight ahead until sights come in line with what you're focused on. So that's the idea. I would probably try it from a couple different positions, like I just described, compressed ready, low ready, high ready, and just focus on, you know, a point on a wall or a target, and then push out. And try to get that to where it happens naturally, quickly, without you having to make a whole lot of adjustments. And that's all part of like training your body to learn this muscle memory of, you know, where the eyes go, my gun goes, and hopefully everything falls right in line. Your thoughts, Jacob?
Yeah, I think this is really important. Let me explain what the opposite is, the what not to do. Just, I know it's obvious, but maybe just to clarify, what you don't want to do is you don't want to be a person who, when you're trying to get the gun onto target, you first look at the gun, you identify the sights, and then you move the gun with your eyes to the target. This is discouraged because then you're essentially having to do two things at the same time. You're having to find the target in your sights, and you have to keep the sights lined up at the same time. And so that's far more difficult than just looking at the target and then bringing the sights to the target, to your eyes. And specifically, I also wanted to add that there needs to be an emphasis on the front sight. It's easier to find that front sight first. So as you bring that gun up onto target, make sure that you bring the front sight to your vision first, to your eyes, to the target, and then line up sights and aim shoot.
Yeah, good thoughts there. And you're absolutely correct in the what you don't want to do. It is certainly a lot faster to focus on a target and then you know, bring the sites in line with that target. We actually talked about this in a similar manner when we talked about transitioning from target to target. And I believe we called that training tip leading with your eyes. It's the exact same concept, you know, mm-hmm. where you just got done shooting and addressing one target. And then rather than turning with your arms, hands, gun, eyes, everything at the same time to the other target, you actually want to look at the other target and then bring the hands and gun over to it. All for the same reason. It's faster. It's a lot more intuitive as well.
Yep.
Cool. There you go. There's our training tip for this Monday. Let's jump now into the moose. Jacob, I really need to slow
that,
down
that would
here.
Be news, Riley, with an N. Yeah.
Is it Monday? It must be Monday, I swear.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, let's jump into the news. Although calling it the moose is kind of fun. Anyway, first up, here's a bill is something that's being considered in Florida. Florida open carry is coming. This is reported on thetruthaboutguns.com. So the primary obstacle to Florida open carry has been removed, it says, this article here. There was a legislator that blocked open carry, which ironically enough, and I remember this, was a Republican senator.
And not just open carry, but also the campus carry bill. He blocked both of them in committee.
Yeah. So, it just is a surprise. We're used to seeing the D after the name when we see politicians that block pro-gun bills. That first actually happened in 2015, where Senator Diaz de la Portilla of Miami-Dade blocked the open carry bill out of committee in 2015. He again blocked it in 2016. And so the good news is, though, that Senator Dwight Bullard, chairman of the Miami-Dade Democrat Party, lost his seat to a Republican, which allows Republicans to maintain their advantage in the Senate. And if I'm not mistaken, was Senator Portilla, Diaz de la Portilla, he lost also by 6,000 votes. So that's the kind of the big news here, was you had this Republican senator who was not really pro-gun in Miami-Dade lose his reelection, okay? And then also the chairman of the Miami-Dade Democrat Party lost his seat. Okay, so a lot of good things happened in Florida last week in the election is what we're getting at here. And so the hope is that this will open up the path, because you had, like I said, Senator Diaz de la Portilla, who kept blocking things in committee, and now he's not even there anymore. So
right. Yeah, this is going to be really interesting, because, I mean, the bill had great positive, you know, feedback from both the House and the Senate in Florida. It looked like it would pass no problem. But this Senator Diaz dude, he killed it in committee. It never got out of committee. It never got to the floor. And so with him out of the way, the theory is that, yeah, both open carry and campus carry should be potential realities now.
Right. Because you have a legislature that is controlled by the Republicans. And since you know, we generally know where a lot of those Republicans stand on Second Amendment, there's a high probability in this next year's worth of legislation in Florida that we'll see some very positive strides in the direction of pro-Second Amendment legislation.
Yep.
So good news there out of Florida. That was a good win for last week there in the election. On to some other news, and this is more legislation coming to us from the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel.
I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, and we all know, you know, Wisconsin did something really interesting last week in the election, and it went red as far as it voted Trump in the general presidential election. But there's also good things happening on a statewide basis, and this is a proposed bill that would allow licensed guns at private schools. Jacob, take it.
Yeah, this lawmaker, State Representative Jesse Kramer, he must be listening to the podcast, and I think he heard our episode last Wednesday when we talked about being better marketers for pro-gun legislation, because this guy is smart. He's really smart. I love this bill, because this is what happens. A lot of times in a lot of these states, we come with some bill that says, guns can now be carried in schools. And like, of course, that's going to get defeated. That takes a ton of support to get that passed. But State Representative Jesse Kramer in Wisconsin, he did something really clever. This bill that he's proposing does not necessarily say that, oh, guns are just allowed in school now. What he says is that the bill would essentially allow an exemption for those with concealed carry to have it on the property, but it would leave it up to the school itself to decide if guns could be allowed in the school, and if so, under what circumstances. And even that only applying to private schools. Right. So what he's essentially doing is saying, what would be the lowest hanging fruit, like the most likely thing I could get passed so that I could start to create a track record to show that it's a viable solution? And so in his mind, it's like, okay, let's not touch public schools. Let's just go to private schools. And even there, let's just allow them on the property so that, you know, teachers and people could leave them in their cars. And then let's enable the school administration, if they choose, to allow the guns into the school on their rules. Like, it's extraordinarily low-hanging fruit, right? Like, this should be very easy to get past, in my opinion, because it's so easy, right? Like, it's just not that, we're not asking for a lot here. And if it gets passed, inevitably there will be some private schools who will allow guns into the building, and they'll have set up some rules or some requirements for teachers or whatever. And that'll start to create a track record so that in the future, someone, you know, the same representative or someone else could propose a bill and say, hey, look what we did so many years ago. There haven't been any incidents. Let's expand that.
Yeah. And you're right. As far as this State Representative Kramer taking the approach of better marketing, I guess would be one way of phrasing it. You know, he says right here, he said, the effort is targeting private schools first because, quote, it's an easier lift politically, which is so true. And by the way, I mean, this is the exact approach that the gun grabbers use. They will always... Yep. You know, little by little by little by little, you know, erode at Second Amendment rights. You know, they'll take whatever they can get, and they'll take these little tiny baby steps, knowing that over time that builds up some political momentum. It also builds up, you know, and kind of preps people, conditions them really to being more open to accepting additional infringements on rights. I compare it, and I don't mean to make this about drugs, but I compare it a little bit to the way things have gone here in Colorado as it relates to marijuana and also a lot of other states. I remember when things were passed, you know, as far as medical marijuana, and I remember thinking, this is only the next step to getting, you know, full on out, you know, all out recreational marijuana. Now, whether you're on whatever side, I don't really care. But the point is that was, I believe, a very strategic move to, you know, make it to be a little bit more acceptable on the medical side and then, you know, go to make that next jump. So this is a very great thing to see, I think, out of Wisconsin, especially where it is still a state, although there are many wonderful gun owners there, many people in general that support the Second Amendment, it still is a state that tends to lean blue, but appears more recently to start to kind of come back more towards the right, at least on the issue of Second Amendment. And this is huge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, taking these little steps is a great thing. And it's so much better. You know, I remember a few years ago here in Colorado, a law that was being talked about, and a prominent gun organization here in Colorado would not get on board because they didn't see it as being enough. And I'm thinking, a win is a win. And as we just talked about, like, taking those steps and building up some political momentum as opposed to trying to go all out for a much bigger step, a much bigger bill, like, it's too much too fast for a lot of people, and they're not willing to accept it.
That's right. Yeah, I think this is genius, and I'd like to see more initiatives like this. Like, let's make it as easy to swallow as possible.
Yep.
As easy to swallow as possible.
Yeah. So good stuff coming to us out of Florida. Good stuff coming out of Wisconsin. So happy to see this. And we wish you all the best in those two states in these upcoming legislative sessions. So on to another great story, and this is I know that this is on a lot of people's minds right now, and it came right out like a day or two after the presidential election. As far as I think, there was an article that talked about the first five things Trump's going to do, you know, on Second Amendment issues or something like that. And one of those, I think the first one mentioned was national reciprocity. Is that something that he's going to be able to accomplish? And he's talked about it, right? So this article is basically talking about that. You know, currently we exist in a system where states, concealed carry from state to state to state to state, is either allowed or not allowed because states have either made the effort to establish reciprocity agreements with other states, right? There's really two types of situations, Jacob, where you can, maybe almost three, where you can carry concealed in a state other than the one you reside in, right? One where you have a formal reciprocity agreement between two states where, you have a permit from one state and the other state will honor a permit from your state. Okay, the other situation is where a state simply decides they agree to allow, they will recognize other state permits, but not necessarily within the confines of a formal reciprocity agreement, right? And then there's other states that probably just don't care, where they, like Virginia is kind of in that category now. We'll just accept all permits. So is Utah. So, national reciprocity. I don't know. What do you think, Jacob?
Yeah, this is one of those interesting things where anyone who's a self-defense shooter would love to have national reciprocity. We all hate dealing with the drama of traveling around the country, so I don't think there's anyone who's inclined to say, nah, not for me, or we don't need that. I do remember when we were launching American Gun Law and we were having people take surveys and tell us what their biggest legal concerns were, and without question, of the top three most common responses we hear when we ask people, what are you worried about with gun rights, or what is your biggest concern relative to gun law? That of the top three, one of them is always, 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 always dealing with the laws as they change from state to state. People hate it.
Yep.
Now, national reciprocity would not necessarily completely change that problem. What reciprocity would do is it would make it so that my permit is good anywhere, I could carry concealed anywhere, but it wouldn't mean that all state laws are the same. So here's what I think is I give you my three pieces of thoughts on this subject. Number one, I don't know that Trump can make it happen. It's not something that a president can do on his own. It definitely requires legislation, which means both houses of Congress have to do it. Do the Republicans control the House and the Senate? Yes, they do. But is a very small majority in the Senate strong enough to get it passed? I don't think so. I think that you really need 60 or so votes to make this happen, and I don't think that it'll get through. I don't think the Democrats are going to let up any leeway. So I'm inclined to say I don't know that he can pass it anyway. But even if he did, my second thought, and this is really, I'm stealing one from Riley. Riley's has really brought this to my mind, is that states won't put up with it. They'll file lawsuits and they'll say, screw you. I mean, states already legalized marijuana. That's illegal. So if the feds say you have to honor all permits, can't a state say, screw you, we're not going to? I mean, I don't know how that's different than saying than a state legalizing marijuana when it's against the federal law. And then the third thought, which I think is really, really, really important, is that even if they did completely legalize, reciprocity, that doesn't mean that that I can do anything I could do in Colorado anywhere else. That I still have to follow the state's gun laws when I'm there. So the other backlash would be for the state to just change their laws. So for example, New Jersey, who hates concealed carry, if they are now forced to honor my permit, they can still say, well, even with a permit, you have the following restrictions. So they can change the law in such a way as to make it so that even with a permit, you pretty much still can't have a concealed gun like anywhere ever. So that would be the other way to backlash, is even if the law could get passed, the states still have control over what someone with a permit could do. And so that while that would help me out in a lot of places like Nevada, which chooses not to honor the Colorado permit currently, now it would have to, and their gun laws are pretty good today, you'll find that the worst states that currently don't want to honor any permit, they still basically won't, because they'll just change their gun laws to make it so that even with a permit, you basically can't do anything or go anywhere. And you'll have other states who will use that as leverage, I think, to enforce even tougher gun laws. You might have an Illinois, for example, who takes two steps back and says, oh, geez, we were only honoring honoring permits from 8 states. Now we're being forced to honor them from 50. Let's make it so that even with a permit, you have to do X, Y, and Z so that we can kind of lock this down. So I think those are the three things that I think are worth considering. One, could he get it through? I don't know. Even if he did, will states put up with that? I don't think so. And even if they did put up with it, they still have the power of controlling the laws that determine what people with concealed carry permits can and can't do.
Yep. Yeah, it's good analysis. And we have talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. But that pretty much sums it all up. And, I've been on record as saying, I mean, would I love to have national reciprocity? Absolutely. Like, that would be awesome as heck. But I actually, there's a part of me that is really torn on the issue because I'm a huge believer in states' rights. And I kind of see it as, if the federal government really puts a foot down on this and passes a bill that creates national reciprocity, I kind of see it as a slap, in the face of a lot of states' rights, because New York and California and Hawaii and Illinois, I mean, we know those are going to be states that are going to fight, against this. And I have to kind of say, rightfully so, to an extent, as far as states' rights are concerned. I mean, I won't necessarily agree with those states on their stances on Second Amendment issues, but as far as states versus federal rights, I mean, this is a big issue for me. Anyway, let's move on. We don't mean to be a downer, by the way. After the good news that came out of the election as far as, what that might mean for the Second Amendment in our country, although we touched on last week about some of the things that did happen that went against the Second Amendment, like in California and Nevada and Washington was another, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. I don't mean to be a downer talking about national reciprocity. People are going to get excited, and then we kind of say, nah, it's probably not going to happen. I'm sorry, but we are just kind of reporting on it and also, making sure we have a reality check. And if you support this and you want to fight for it, by all means, please, please. And in fact, if someone comes to me and says, would you support national reciprocity? I'd probably say, yeah, because I'd love to have it. But I am torn. All right. Moving on to a story from guns.com. Remington is hit with a lawsuit over the Walker trigger.
Yeah, this is an interesting one.
Yeah. So this is interesting, right? Because, Remington, their Model 700 rifle, it's been around for decades. It's a classic rifle. It's a great rifle, a very accurate rifle, and one that... personally, I'm a fan of. I've owned Model 700s, and they're great rifles. Way back when, like 2-3 decades ago, there was lawsuits about the trigger and about, guns that just would fire for no particular reason. And apparently, here is yet another lawsuit over the Model 700 rifle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and there was a recall issued. But I think that the argument being made, and the argument that has been made in past lawsuits, is that the recall came too late, that they didn't do a good job of communicating to customers that there was an issue. And even when they did issue the recall, they still didn't communicate it very well. They didn't do what is reasonable or requisite to communicate the recall. And so this particular individual who's filing this lawsuit, he would say the rifle shot him. While he was hunting, shot him in the leg, and he argues that has had a significant impact on his quality of life and earnings, and so the lawsuit seeks damages in excess of $1 million.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Remington, way back when, tried to fix this, and they. It's discouraging to see that this is still an issue, that it's still, to your points, Jacob, you're right in that. And maybe that some things were not done as proactively as they could have been and whatnot. To be honest with you, I thought we'd heard the last of this trigger issue. And apparently we haven't. So we'll see how this lawsuit plays out. It started, by the way, with a story of a hunter. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce his name. Macio Nave. I don't know. It's an interesting name. But apparently he was just trying to sling his Model 700 over his shoulder, and the gun fired. Apparently with nothing engaging the trigger, and then a round struck him in his right lower leg. You know, I have to almost play a little bit devil's advocate here too, Jacob, because, you know, like, he says nothing engages the trigger. But, like, I mean, how do you really know that?
Yeah, how do we know he didn't just actually shoot himself and feel like an idiot? He was alone, by the way, no witnesses. He dragged
right.
himself
that's
back to
point.
The truck where his friends helped him to the hospital.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's exactly my point, is like, there are no witnesses, you know, and is this a opportunity that was seen, you know, oh gosh, I shot myself, but it was with a Remington Model 700, you know, maybe I could sue them over this, you know, and say it was as this or that. You know, a couple years ago, I had a situation with a hunting buddy who, as he was getting ready to open the bolt and unload his hunting rifle, it all of a sudden just fired. But it was cold weather. We were all wearing heavy clothing, gloves, you know, stuff like that. And he swears he didn't touch the trigger. You know, I was watching him. I didn't see him touch the trigger. And to be honest with you, by the way, it was not a Remington Model 700. It was, I can't remember exactly now. I think it was a Seiko rifle. They've not had any reports to my knowledge of trigger problems. And honestly, we got done with it. He had a gunsmith check it out. But after the fact, kind of looking back and talking about it, we kind of just determined he must have somehow, you know, with those big oversized gloves or something, snagged the trigger. I mean, you have, you know, very light triggers on these hunting rifles. Anyway, I don't know. Just some things to think about.
To me, here'd be a message from me based on this is, like, we count on firearms to be, you know, to be manufactured properly and to operate correctly. But that doesn't mean it's okay to point a gun at someone or yourself. Right. I mean,
right.
When I read this story, my first thought was you are in violation of a core safety rule.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, safety rules. Okay. I agree with you.
I'm not
there.
Excusing Remington's, you know, poor tool or trigger or whatever. I'm simply saying that, you know, in the story you told with you and your buddy, no one got shot, right?
No, nobody got shot. He was keeping it pointing in a safe direction.
There you go.
This is interesting because he's trying to sling his rifle and, you know, in general, but I would say this, okay, don't have a round in the chamber, even if safety is on and you're throwing, you know, a rifle over your back with a sling, because you don't have control over it, okay? I mean, I'm willing to admit that as a hunter, I've gone out there, I'm actively stalking an animal, and I've got a round in the chamber, safety on, because I might have that shot any second. Okay, but I'm not doing that. I'm not having that rifle be just slung over my shoulder, chambered, ready to go. It's in my hands. I've got full control of it, you know, and when I've got that shot, I'm ready to take that shot. But all other times, you know, you should have a clear rifle. That's kind of my take on this. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there could be some personal fall in this as well. Absolutely. All right, another story. This is on a more somber note, of course, and we've recently had quite a rash of police shootings in this country. We all know that. There was just one not even a month ago now that kind of is similar. I mean, I think that one was in California where two officers were responding to a burglary and one gets shot and killed. The other one also gets wounded. This is a similar story, okay? This is coming to us from Cannonsburg. It was Pennsylvania, right? And one officer is dead and another is wounded after they were ambushed early Thursday morning in a town about 20 miles southwest of Pittsburgh, the article from guns.com says. These two officers responding to a domestic disturbance call just after 3 a.m., and they arrive at the scene and they are immediately ambushed.
Yeah, this was an apartment complex, to kind of put this in context, you know, in case anyone is trying to judge this or imagine this in your head. You know, these officers, they're pulling up to an apartment complex. There's tons of windows and doors and huge parking lot probably, and they pull in and, you know, they don't get far from their car before they're getting shot at. In fact, it was funny because it was hours later that they actually found the shooter. Who was dead, had shot himself after the fact. But, you know, the point is that it wasn't clear even after the fact where the shots had come from, let alone when it occurred, right? Officers just arrive and shots are being fired. So ambush is a very appropriate term here. The shooter, the BG in this case, this guy had a restraining order against him by a woman. And the woman, I don't know if she was armed. I don't know if she'd ever thought about any protection beyond just the piece of paper that meant he couldn't come near her, but didn't work out too well because, you know, he assaulted this woman. And after he shot at the cops and killed one of them, he shot her and then shot himself. And she was pregnant. So this is really a situation where, you know, three good people died, you know, an officer, a woman, and her unborn baby.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you know what's going to happen here, Jacob, is folks from Washington that just passed that extreme
risk protection order.
Risk protection order. They're going to point at that and say, this is why we passed that law.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
Because they're going to point at this as an example. And I'm curious on your take on this. You know, they're going to point at this as an example and say, if she had had an extreme risk protection order, the ability to have that against this man, that may have saved her life. What do you think?
It very well might have, right? I mean, if she had had that extreme risk protection order, would that have saved her life? Possibly. You know, the cops could have shown up and taken this dude's guns, and maybe he, in some, you know, drunk rage, wouldn't have had his guns with him to be able to run over there and beat on the woman. So it's debatable, but it's also debatable whether or not she could have gotten an extreme risk protection order, since in order to get one, one has to prove that the person is likely to become violent. And a lot of times in these situations, there's nothing to suggest this person is going to become violent. You know, to the point that the extreme risk protection order could be issued. So we don't really know enough to say what this, that, or the other thing. But it is debatable that it could have had an effect. It could have been helpful. But I'll add this. It probably wouldn't have required the ex parte extreme risk protection order that they passed in this legislation, which essentially would allow that the cops could show up and take away his guns without him even having to attend a hearing, you know, without any, you know, due process at all.
Yeah, that is kind of where I'm going with this is that the concern is not necessarily – I don't have a problem with somebody having their rights violated when they are – when there's due process involved, okay, and under lawful order issued by a judge, you know, an order, a protection order is issued that, you know, maybe would have worked in this case, okay, potentially. But my problem is with that law in Washington is the lack of due process in, you know, a lot of the steps, mm-hmm. you know, towards getting one of those orders as far as protecting the rights of the individual those orders are going against.
Right.
Very, very little due process in a number of areas there. But so back to the story, though. We have one police officer that's dead, another that is wounded. I believe the wounded officer is going to be okay. But this is tragic, and it shouldn't have happened, of course. But, you know, what do we take from this? You know, I don't know, except that, you know, be vigilant and be diligent in, you know, your training and being as best as you can aware of what's going on around you. And you know what? Unfortunately, we can't always prepare for every situation and every circumstance that might present itself, but we can certainly take steps toward, you know, being as best prepared as we possibly can. And hopefully that's enough. Also, a story out of Florida, another one. 25 people arrested in a Florida drug and gun trafficking ring. Broward County, Florida, on last Wednesday, 25 suspects were arrested in a raid at a home, which, wow, like 25 people in a single home? That's pretty.
Yeah, I don't think that home was being used as a residence.
that's a good group there. But apparently this was the result of a two-year undercover investigation into a gun and drug trafficking operation that was operated by two local gangs. We're just reporting on it, saying this is great. You know, I mean, I'm happy to see guys like this get busted and hopefully, you know, take a lot of drugs, a lot of money, and a lot of illegal guns off the streets.
Yeah. It said that the undercover agents bought a total of 285 firearms from the defendants over the course of the two-year investigation. That's impressive.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a lot of guns.
I read that and I have to ask the question. I think it's an obvious one. Why did it take so long?
Well, I suspect, you know, in a lot of these circumstances, having a little bit of, I know somebody who's been involved in these kinds of busts, and the short of it is, it's all bucketing to the top. Like a lot of these times you're dealing with all the underlings, and busting those people doesn't actually stop the action. Like you keep that investigation going long enough until you can indict the leaders, the players, so that you can really shut down what's going on.
No, I get that. I just was just asking the question.
Yeah,
I
mean, well, it does seem
like 285 guns that undercover agents bought over the course of 2 years. And they included AR-15s, AK-47s, a whole host of pistols, revolvers, a short barrel rifle, and a police sniper rifle. Yeah, wow. Well, you know, like I said, I'm happy to see these guys behind bars and to see this trafficking ring brought down. So, now that brings us to our favorite segment on the podcast, which is our Justified segment. And first up, we have a story. This is written on our WashingtonGunClasses.com website up there in Washington, of course, which we've talked about quite a bit recently with some of the laws that they've passed and whatnot. This is man issues citizen's arrest on man who hit a child with his truck on Halloween. So
yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah, we have a 38-year-old man who was arrested on Halloween night after a trio of neighbors kept him from fleeing the scene after he ran over a young boy who was out trick-or-treating near the intersection of North 9th and North I Streets. And this was, by the way, in Pierce County, which is, let's see, I forgot the town now. I believe it's Tacoma is the area.
Tacoma, yep. Yeah, I read it because I thought he had been hit with a Tacoma.
Which you just bought.
right. But he was hit with an SUV in Tacoma. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, our hearts go out to this child who, by the way, is in critical condition with a fractured skull, missing teeth, and bruises from head to toe. But as of this time, appears to be making a recovery. The boy was crossing the street holding his father's hand when he was hit by the Toyota 4Runner driven by this 38-year-old suspect. The father was brushed by the car but not injured. But apparently hit his child straight on. So a woman driving the other north on North I Street said she stopped the car. She had seen the car hit the child, and that the car continued a bit before stopping. And apparently this guy driving the Toyota 4Runner was going to attempt to leave the scene, and that was before a number of citizens in the area, three of them, I believe, basically stopped him from leaving, issued a citizen's arrest.
Yeah, they get in front of the car, right? And they're like, hey, you know, and he's bumping into them. And they're like, nah, no, we're not moving. And eventually, kind of getting a hint of what was going on, a man whose wife was standing in front of the getaway car approaches the vehicle and draws his fire and says, yeah, no, seriously, you're not leaving.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and that's the part I thought was rather interesting, is that this guy felt necessary to draw a gun. I'm not going to question that necessarily one bit. I'm going to focus a little bit more on the citizen's arrest concept, which we've talked about. And the one thing that's really key here is you have several individuals who witnessed this occur. And in most states, the way citizen's arrest statutes are worded, it involves, you know, if you are going to make a citizen's arrest, you have to have firsthand witnessed a crime committed, and you've got to be able to, and this is not necessarily what the statute would say, but this is very important to keep in mind. So you've witnessed a crime occur, and I would say that you got to be able to articulate very clearly what that crime was and have a pretty good knowledge that is, in fact, you know, but this one's pretty, you know, cut and dry here, as far as, you know, three people at least see this guy run over this child, right? And then he's acting like he's going to flee the scene. A crime has been committed, and they saw it firsthand, and they were quite justified in this matter in arresting him and waiting for cops to arrive.
Yeah, I mean, if I would have been this man, I wouldn't have been making statements like he made and saying things like what he said. I probably would have, you know, said something more like, hey, I was just trying to prevent him from running into more people, running over more people. You know, I would have focused, you know, if I had to make a statement, I would have made that statement based on, you know, future harm that could have been caused, and not about stopping him from fleeing from the scene. So yeah, go back to episode one, re-listen to that one, everyone, and you'll hear our thoughts about citizen's arrest and potential legal consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You know, the interesting thing here in the story is that this guy, Michael, what was his name? Michael Lester, that was his name. He's one of the neighbors that runs over, and he's got a concealed carry firearm. And when he sees this guy try to bail, that's when he draws the gun. And he kind of uses the gun to effect the arrest. That would be the one thing as a caution. It'd be like, you know, that's not really something I'd encourage that you do. You know, in a similar situation, unless an officer felt there was a threat to life or safety, they wouldn't necessarily even draw a weapon, you know, just because they got a guy that's bailing a car, you know, I mean, like, or running away, you know, like, you just really got to be super, super careful with this sort of thing. Now, it doesn't appear that any of the Good Samaritans are going to be charged with anything, but just something to be aware of and think of. And I know we've talked on it and talked on it and talked on it, and yet we see story after story where people make decisions that could get them legally in hot water. So just be advised. All right, next up, I'm going to let you take the lead on this one, Jacob. Guns.com, suspect shot brother in custody following home invasion.
This is interesting. So these are three convicted felons, which is probably the most interesting thing, including the armed homeowner. So two gentlemen, brothers, apparently, they forced their way inside of a home. And this is not random. This is a domestic-related issue, so they know the homeowner, and they're very intent on getting into this home and confronting the homeowner. So they force their way in, and as I understand it, from what I could read, the shots don't ring out immediately, that there is a bit of a confrontation and maybe some discussion. Not entirely sure, you know, what that entailed or how long that lasted, but the homeowner opens fire, and hits one of the intruders, Graves, I think is the name that's being used here, and misses the other. And so then Graves and Flood, they're the bad dudes, they run out, and one of them, one has not been shot, Flood, he turns and opens fire, shooting several rounds back at the house and through the closed door. The homeowner, Lampkins is his name, he calls the police. And so you got two bad guys run off, one's got holes in him, and then the homeowner who calls the police. The bad guy who has holes in him, he ends up at a hospital dead on site, and his accomplice, the Flood guy, is there with him. And so the Flood is taken into custody and arrested. Now, the homeowner, this is the interesting part, at the very bottom of the article here on guns.com, the homeowner is not charged, as far as we can tell, for shooting, but he is being held because he was arrested as being a convicted felon in possession of a firearm. Turns out he's not allowed to have guns.
Yeah, that's you would think that he would know that.
Well, and frankly, in this case, he'd probably be the first one to say, thank goodness I did.
Yeah. No, I know that logic as well. I know an individual who, you know, unfortunately has a felony on his record dating way back when, you know, and he came to me and asked the question once upon a time, you know, like, I'm concerned about my safety in my home, you know, I'm thinking about getting a gun. And I'm like, dude, what are you thinking? Mm-hmm. Like, don't do it. He's like, if it comes down to me being alive or going back to jail, he's like, I'll go back to jail. I'm like, and ultimately, I don't think he ended up getting a gun. But I mean, but still, like, I kind of understand the feeling, mostly because I know an individual that's in that same boat. Anyway, yeah, this is a really interesting story because of that little twist right there. I mean, you have essentially what is a justified shooting. And as you said, he's not being charged with defending himself, but he is being charged for being a convicted felon in possession of a firearm. So that's kind of, you know, too bad to see. But, you know, then again, this guy made a mistake at some point in his life himself, and he's got to pay the price for that as well. So on now to our final story, coming to us from the WCF Courier, Cedar Falls. Crap, I forgot what state this is, Jacob.
Iowa, probably. Cedar Falls.
Right. Duh, yeah. I knew that. Cedar Falls, Iowa. We have a man with a permit to carry a firearm who detained a Cedar Falls man when he started stabbing people at his apartment building last month. Now, get this. This blew my mind, Jacob. Nobody ended up dying in this attack. Okay, so on October 17th, there was this attack in this apartment, and the suspect, Adam Jacobson, stabbed his fellow tenant. Okay, so these two guys live together. They live in the same apartment, and I don't know whether it started over an argument or what, but he stabs his roommate, essentially Jeffrey Miller, 24 times. And then apartment manager Denise Bennett was stabbed 8 times. And I believe it's because, you know, she tried to intervene. Okay. Mm-hmm. And another, I believe, resident thereby or nearby there or in one of the apartments, Daniel Williams, who had a concealed carry permit, he drew his firearm and ordered Mr. Jacobson, the guy who was doing the stabbing, to lie on the ground.
Yeah. So the good Samaritan with the gun was actually the boyfriend of one of the other involved stabbing people. And so he essentially, I think, or that's how I understood it. He arrived at the apartment complex a few minutes after this had all started. And yeah, he took action. It's really interesting here because, as you mentioned, no one died, right? So, I mean, he very well would have been probably legally justified. And I suspect, you know, many listeners of this podcast, if they had been in the same situation, would have just started shooting. Mm-hmm. But he didn't start shooting. Instead, he drew and, you know, just ordered the man on the ground, which the guy complied.
Yeah. Now, this was because, you know, I mean, where this was resolved was actually outside of the apartment. And, you know, so it brings up a really great point, and one that, you know where we stand on this. And that is, you know, there are many people that while they would be in support of firearm ownership and firearm ownership within a, you know, within a home, like you can keep your guns in your home and even, you know, deadly force within your home is acceptable. But, you know, those same people might not necessarily agree with allowing people to carry firearms for self-defense outside of the home. And I think Hillary Clinton would be on that side. But this is a great, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we feature so many of these justified stories the way we do. I mean, we've already featured a couple of them today where lawful, you know, citizens of society carrying legally concealed on their person firearms are able to stop situations and save lives because they are able to do so, because they're able to exercise that Second Amendment right, that privilege of carrying on their person, even outside of the home, firearms for lawful defense and protection. And this situation, the amazing thing to me was that this Jeffrey Miller was stabbed 24 times, and apparently he's going to live. That's an incredible amount of times to be stabbed and come out of that. And so, you know, would this, Adam Jacobson had stopped had, Daniel Williams not been there and able to draw his gun, you know, probably not. And it really reminds me very much so of, what was that episode, Jacob? I don't remember the exact number now. It's been so long ago now. But one of my favorite episodes of all time where we had Daryl Paco Sarter on, right? And what did he do? He stopped a daughter stabbing her mother because he was there and he was able to draw his gun.
Also, no shots fired in that story.
Right. Exactly.
Episode 28.
Yeah, you know, when people talk about, well, you know, how deadly guns are and how people are going to get shot and it's going to turn into Wild Wild West, but so often situations are able to be resolved even without a shot being fired. And I would that prompts my thought process as well to think that how often do the gun grabbers try to demonize gun owners and how violent we are and how, you know, the propensity we have towards, you know, being violent and, you know, we don't have self-control. Yet the self-control that is exercised in these situations where people might, under the law, be justified in actually pulling the trigger because deadly force is, in fact, actually being used in that very moment. And in many states, you could just simply draw your gun out and just start firing. Yet, people use and exercise so much self-control because they understand the responsibility and the great power that they have that's granted them by the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I love it. I love it when guns resolve issues with no shot fired. Like, it is the epitome of the intention, right? I mean, it is the ultimate example of, you know, why we do what we do and the power that comes from the great equalizer.
Yeah, indeed. So that's going to wrap it up for today, folks. But first, today's episode is brought to you by the Armory Tool. This small pocket-sized tool makes it super easy to keep in your range bag or gun case. It has several tools all in one, including a handy unloading and loading tool, as well as a 1911 barrel wrench. It facilitates easy loading of any magazine, fully universal. Also, I was going to throw this out, Jacob. This is not an official advertisement, but it has a little hole here, and I've got one sitting right here on my desk. Anybody that's a Ruger shooter, you know the little magazines with that little button that sometimes, for some people, is really difficult to hold on to and push downward as you're loading a Ruger Mark II or mm-hmm. Mark III magazines. It's got a tool for that as well. I'm doing it right here. You can hear it. It's a great little tool. So anyway, the Armory tool. Best of all, Guardian Nation members are going to be getting one free this month. So if you've been on the fence about joining Guardian Nation, now is the time to check it out. Or if you, even if you aren't interested in Guardian Nation, which would be a travesty because, I mean, geez, Jacob, we're only trying to make it the most awesome thing ever.
You can also break our hearts a little.
But you can also just find and buy this Armory tool on our online store. Either way, go check out, this is the link, usafirearmtraining.com/armorytool. That would be A-R-M-O-R-Y-T-O-O-L. For those of you that can't spell, which might be, I don't know. I can spell okay, but anyway. usafirearmtraining.com/armorytool. Armory is not an easy word. That was my point.
Valid point.
Yeah. Anyway, so we'll hope you check that out. Really, really cool little tool. And so with that, you know, and Jacob, you've got an important lunch meeting you got to be to. So that's what this is all about. We're going to wrap it up there, folks. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening and for your continued support of this podcast. We are also thankful for your support of USA Firearm Training, which really is what makes, you know, producing this podcast possible. So thank you all. We hope that you enjoy the rest of your Monday and the rest of this week. We'll see you on our Wednesday episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast and look forward to that there. And also, let's throw out there too, Jacob, this Thursday evening is our monthly webinar for Guardian Nation members.
And that's right. Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Time.
Yep. And so we're getting that ready to go. We'll look forward to seeing a whole bunch of you in that webinar Thursday night at 7 p.m. Mountain. And also, too, and here's one last, I guess, you know, quick call to action. Some of you are aware that we've been trying to rebuild our app. And it's not been going exactly as well as we would have liked. So here's the pitch. If you... or you know somebody who is a skilled app developer with track record, and preferably we'd probably like to work with maybe like a freelancer or at least just, you know, somebody that is flexible and is easy to work with. But it doesn't really matter. As long as we're looking for an app developer to help us finish rebuilding our app, which is in the Apple Store as well as on Google Play. Concealed Carry Gun Tools app, I believe it's called. So if you know somebody, please have them send us a message our way. We'd love to get to know them and hopefully work with them in finishing this app. It was a major priority for us, and we haven't been able to get it done because things haven't worked out so well with our other app developer, unfortunately. So with that, that wraps it up for today. We'll see you Wednesday. Jacob?
Thanks, everyone. Appreciate you being part of our awesome podcast listenership. We love you.
Yep, totally. And this is Riley signing off for the Concealed Carry Podcast. Take care. Goodbye.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.